Yeah, the good news is that I know that you have to prepare a lot. There's no particular preparation for this class. So you just kind of walk in and listen. The bad news is they might put you to sleep since you're not preparing, but hopefully there'll be a trade-off one way or the other. So the first unit that we're going to be talking about are a lot of shailos in medical ethics. By the way, I just came back myself from the United States, so I was involved in a Chabad had its national retreat in Washington, D.C. I don't know if you're aware of it. So, in fact, I actually spoke in a lot of medical ethics, so the reason I'm starting, because it's fresh in my mind, because I just talked about it there, so it's easier for me to come here and talk about it. And the topic we're going to talk about today is organ donation, which is an important topic. There is, in fact, even Jewish organizations that are encouraging people to give organs. There's a website, Halachic Organ Donor Society, which is HODS.org, which is very, very aggressive in calling upon people to give organs. I want to discuss the halachic issues, whether you should be an organ donor, whether you shouldn't be. And the second issue is, are you allowed to be an organ recipient? If, God forbid, a person needed to put themselves on a list, are you allowed to? Is there a difference between donating and taking? And what would the logic of all of that be? So first, in order to understand this, we have to analyze and recognize there are three types of organ donations that have to be considered. And there are three different categories. Category number one is live organ donation. Live organ donation is when I'm alive, I want to give an organ. Now obviously, that doesn't work for a lot of organs. You can't donate your heart when you're alive, because if you do, you will not be alive. Right? So basically, the only real organ that is, well, there are two. There are two organ donations that one can make when they are alive. One is, of course, a kidney donation. And that is because a person is born with two kidneys and you can live with one. So people donate kidneys. The second is a bit surprising, although I'm sure you've heard of it, it's because it's been around a few years. And that is you can do a partial liver donation. That although without a liver you would die, but the liver can regenerate with as little as 20% of its tissue. So it's entirely possible for a healthy person to donate a large part of their liver to somebody who needs it, right? Because his liver will regenerate and hopefully the recipient will get better.
You constantly could donate your liver?
No, no.
Once?
Say again?
Liver rejuvenates itself, can you constantly continue
donating? Yes, you can. Well, I didn't get to the halacha yet, but medically, yeah.
Okay.
You can be a repetitive donor. Yeah, that's correct. Although I will tell you that hospitals do not like to accept liver donation, partial liver donations from parents to children, because they think that the parents will not objectively assess the risks to them and the like, so they rather go to the outside. But okay, so let's ask it in terms of, so let's take category one. If you have a live organ donation, is there any halachic principle that says I should do it, I shouldn't do it, I must do it, or I'm not allowed to do it, right? What is the halacha of live organ donations, kidneys and liver? Now you understand that since we're talking about a live donation, there's a whole bunch of shailos that we don't have to consider. There's no issue of autopsy here, cutting into a dead body, because you're not dying. There's no issue of resurrection of the dead. In other words, all of the questions that you might have with organ donations once a person is dead, you don't have when the person is alive, right? So you've eliminated a whole bunch of questions that you might get to, and we'll get to those other questions later. So here, let me point out that the poskim have only one concern when it comes to a live organ donation, and that is, there is a prohibition in the Torah called self-endangerment. You are not allowed to put yourself in risk. You are not allowed to engage in dangerous behavior. This applies to a whole bunch of things. This applies to bungee jumping.
So
let me explain this. I just made a statement. A person is not allowed to put themselves in danger. Now I made that statement, and that is a true statement. But if you think about that statement, it almost makes no sense standing alone. And you're hitting upon it. What do you mean I'm not allowed to put myself in danger? Every time I go on a bus, particularly in Jerusalem, I'm putting myself in danger. Every time I cross the street, I'm putting myself in danger. And even if you say, well, I'll stay in bed all day, you're putting yourself in danger too. You know, I come from Maryland, Washington, D.C. And I remember that in some of the neighborhoods, there are drug wars. And around 10 years ago, there was an 8-year-old kid who simply got shot. He was in bed. In other words, there was shooting outside of his house, and the walls were so flimsy that bullets went through the walls, and the kid got killed just lying in bed, sleeping. So what do we mean when we say you're not allowed to do dangerous things?
Like acts of
danger. Yeah, but what is you know, what is dangerous things? In other words, everything has some chance of danger.
It has a higher chance.
Right, so our short answer is, and this is very vague, but this is what halacha actually works with, you're not allowed to do things that are called excessively, unreasonably, unusually dangerous. And things that... Now, how do you define what is unusually dangerous? That's a strange definition. And in many ways, this is very strange, halacha allows the society you live in to determine what is considered normal activity and what is considered hazardous activity. If society generally... Now, again, this is unusual. Normally, halacha is outside of society. Halacha tells society how it's supposed to be. But in some areas, a few areas, halacha itself, which means God's will, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will, is shaped by the way human beings live. And the general rule is, whatever human beings generally regard as a safe and normal activity, you are allowed to engage in, even though it is potentially dangerous. Driving, going on buses, potentially it is very dangerous. Going on a plane, actually planes are safer than cars, but these are generally regarded as normal activities, unless you have a great fear, but most normal people go on trains, even though, listen, train, I always thought, you know, I don't like to fly personally, I have to fly. I can't get a train from Israel to America. Trains, I always love trains. When I'm in the States, I'll take a train because trains are so safe. Well, do you remember, was it last summer? How a big train derailed, right? So even trains are dangerous, right? Everything's dangerous. But do you understand the idea? If people consider it to be a normal activity, it's considered to be permitted. So halacha prohibits unusual danger, hazardous activities, but it permits us to engage in what is considered to be safe. Now, this is why 100 years ago, even though some people were aware that cigarette smoking could cause illness, but halakhically cigarette smoking was not forbidden because people considered it to be a normal activity. But some people, some rabbis say, not all, but some rabbis have said, since now it is so well known that cigarette smoking causes emphysema and lung cancer, knowledge itself takes something away from a normal activity to an extra dangerous activity. And there are rabbis, not all, and I'll explain why not all, who actually say halacha prohibits cigarette smoking. Now that's a big machlokas. You'll obviously notice many rabbis in Israel who are heavy smokers, although at Baruch Hashem it's much less than it used to be. I don't want to get into that too much because I want to talk about organization, but let me just tell you what the issue with cigarette smoking would be. Mark Twain once remarked that there are statistics, I messed it up already, there are lies, there are damn lies, excuse my language here, and there are statistics. Statistics are the worst lies of all. And that is, statistics can be labeled in a lot of different ways. Now let me explain how statistics can really mislead you as to whether something is dangerous. Let's take a pesticide. Pesticides kill bugs. In fact, the reason why, by the way, you know, you'll notice people are so worried about bugs and lettuce and broccoli, and every week you're told another thing you can't eat. I don't want to scare you. I'll leave it to your other teachers to scare you. Can't eat raisins and can't eat dates and can't eat this and that. Can't eat strawberries. The only thing you can eat, junk food, you can eat junk food for some reason. Insects don't go into junk foods. I don't know. I guess be grateful for that. But all fruits and vegetables, like, have problems. Now, you wonder, gee, my Bubby and Zadie didn't seem to have these problems. But part of the answer was that when there were heavy use of pesticides, you know, maybe you'd get cancer, but that killed the insects. Now they stop using pesticides so much, so there's more insect infestation in it. That's why organic is halakhically sometimes very problematical, because the fewer pesticides, the more insect. Okay, now I'm going to make up a number just to illustrate. My numbers are not accurate. Let's assume you have a certain pesticide, that when that pesticide is used, there's a 1 in 100,000 chance that somebody will get cancer. 1 in 100,000 chance. And let's say without the pesticide, naturally, there's a 1 in a million chance. So, I could describe using the pesticide in two ways. And if I describe it in one way, you're going to say, oh, that's so dangerous. If I describe it another way, you say, oh, not so bad. If I tell you, if you eat this fruit having this pesticide, there's a 1 in 100,000 chance you'll get sick, that doesn't necessarily sound so bad. 1 in 100,000, or let's say it's a 1 in 500,000. But I could say it in another way. If you eat this fruit, your chances of getting cancer are multiplied by 10. It's 10 times more likely. There's 1,000% more chance you'll get cancer. That sounds really scary. To be a little more technical, something can have a relatively low incidence of risk, but it could be a great magnification of risk. See the difference between incidence and magnification. In fact, I could extrapolate this even further. Let's say without the dangerous activity, there's a 1 in 10 million. And with the dangerous activity, it's a 1 in a million. It's still 1 in a million, but it's 10 times worse. When halacha defines an activity as unreasonably dangerous, is it looking at the actual incidence of the risk? Or is it looking at its magnitude vis-a-vis what would have been without it? Something can have a high magnitude of risk, meaning it multiplies the risk, but it could still be relatively small. Now, cigarette smoking, again, on some level falls under that paradigm. Smokers are many, many, many more times likely to get lung cancer than non-smokers. But most smokers do not get lung cancer. So those who permit say, well, smoking is not dangerous. It magnifies the risk, but the risk is still relatively small. Now, again, I don't want to argue with numbers. Smoking is certainly a bad thing. And even the rabbis who are unwilling to prohibit smoking say, if you didn't start yet, please don't start. But I'm just explaining that I really want to focus on the general concept that magnitude of risk and incidence of risk are two different statistical concepts, and there is a big, big debate in halacha. What is halacha looking at when halacha defines things as dangerous? And with pesticides, for example, it's even more complicated, because pesticides, particularly in starving countries, can radically increase a crop yield. So here's a fascinating calculation that you'd have to make in halacha and in public policy. Let's assume that without pesticides, I'll only be able to feed 100,000 people. With pesticides, I'll be able to feed 500,000 people. But the incidence of cancer sharply goes up. Now, you can't just say, oh, the pesticides are no good because it's going to cause some people to die. Well, if you don't use pesticides, some people are going to die of starvation. Right? If I use the pesticides, I'll have fewer people dying of starvation, but some people will die of cancer who wouldn't have died of cancer. So this is harder than you would think, because the question then becomes, well, sure, I shouldn't do something that causes people to die, but if not using it is going to cause other people to die, You know, how do you make the decision? Do you look at how many people will die of starvation without the pesticide versus how many people will die of cancer if I use the pesticide? And do you simply say, well, if more people would have died of starvation without, then we'll die with the pesticide? That would be a justifiable decision. Or do you basically say that halachic philosophy is, you don't know that they're the same people. What gives you the right to condemn some people to cancer because you want to save other people? That's like the famous trolley problem, which is an enormously interesting issue, halachically as well as philosophically. I'm driving a trolley and I lose control of the brakes, and there are five kids that are in front of the trolley. If I don't do anything, I'm going to run over five kids, but I could turn it onto a side path in which there's a man who fell asleep on the track. And if I turn the train, I'm going to run him over and kill him, but I'm going to save five lives. Do I simply do nothing and kill five children? Or do I turn the trolley and kill one person? Is it moral to deliberately kill one person in order to save five? According to halacha, the answer might be you're not allowed to do that, as tragic as that sounds. And the pesticides thing is a variation on that, because essentially what I'm doing is, in order to save X number of people from starvation, I'm going to do something that's going to cause Y number of people to die of cancer. Okay, complicated. It's not our topic tonight, but did you want to, you had your hand up.
Yeah, that's a guarantee.
Yeah,
yeah. About fruits and pesticides, you take something good about fruits. About cigarettes, you get nothing good.
That is a good point. You know, it is interesting, though, that in the 19th century and the early 20th century, they used to actually talk about the medicinal benefits of cigarettes. Now, maybe a lot of it is false, but they would say it helps digestion, all sorts of things. Yeah, it helps concentration, you know, who knows.
Because
nicotine is addictive, there's no question that it does calm your nerves, like any narcotic. I mean, it can calm you down. What was it? There was an old, ancient, before you were born, an ancient Woody Allen movie, Sleeper, going all the way back, this goes back to the early 1960s, where I think he wakes up after a trance, he wakes up in the 21st century, and he discovers that he's really happy because he discovers that broccoli causes cancer, but ice cream and French fries, you know, are health foods that promote. So you never know. Kadosh Baruch has all sorts of surprises that there's going to be there. And now eggs are considered to be, I think a lot of people say, there's no, you know, the cholesterol of eggs is not even a problem anymore. You know, so you never know. Kadosh Baruch reveals different things at different times. Yeah.
Wait, what does Halacha say about the trolley problem?
Okay, we should give a whole share of this, but the basic idea in halacha is you're not allowed to kill one person in order to save a bunch of other people. Because since halacha considers every life of infinite value, you are not allowed to say those five children are more valuable.
But if you're in a situation and you do it, but you're not, if it's not going to give you permission, no?
What do you mean somebody gives you permission?
No, I'm saying, like, halacha's not going to say it's okay, but if you're in that situation to go either right and kill five people or go left and kill one person.
Well, no. In other words, what I'm saying is halacha compels inertia. Now, inertia means like this. I mean, if you had to make a turn one way or the other, you would turn to kill the fewer people. That's correct. But if you're on the road, you're already on the road,
that's gonna
kill those five, you're not allowed to make a new decision to turn it off and kill the one. Because that's the famous case. Maimonides gives you a very famous case. Non-Jews surround a city. Non-Jews, like an army, like Nazis. They surround a city. And they say, give us a Jew that we want to kill. We want to kill a Jew for fun. They don't ask for a specific person. Give us a Jew.
What do you do?
Or if you don't give us a Jew to kill, we will wipe out the whole city. So Maimonides rules, we have to let the whole city die and not choose a person to die. Now, it's different if they ask. If they ask for a specific person, they say, we're looking for George. That's a different reason. We'll go over that later. But the general rule is, you can't kill one person to save another person. And not only that, you can't kill one person to save 100 people. Because in the infinity of life, the Talmud has an expression. Who says your blood is redder than somebody else's blood? For some reason, they always translate it sweeter. I don't know why they translate sweeter is not the right translation. The word in Aramaic is red, not sweet. Meaning to say, it's an amazing thing. We don't know who's... And this is pretty amazing. Let me give you an example of how extreme this is. This is very, very extreme. Let's say somebody says to you, kill this person, or we will kill you or kill somebody else. Now, even if the person they're threatening to kill is the greatest tzaddik and rabbi and saint in the world, and the person you're asked to kill is some drug addict, teenage bum, who doesn't seem to do anything good. So you would think, certainly it's much better to kill him and have the great tzaddik alive. Halacha says, as strange as this is, we are not allowed to assume who is better than somebody else. We cannot murder one person to save another. And that's the basis of the trolley issue. That the trolley issue basically says, you can't. So to extrapolate it, again, I'm not giving you an answer, this is part of the problem with the pesticide risk issue. And that is, you're essentially doing something that's going to condemn an unknown number of people to cancer in order to save an unknown number of people from starvation. And the question becomes, isn't that kind of analogous to the trolley issue of endangering some people in order to save other people? Difficult questions. These are difficult. Well,
you're kind of taking it upon yourself because if not, you can technically buy organic.
I'm just talking about
choosing to buy it or not.
No, I understand that. All I'm asking is that, the people who make these decisions about pesticides and organic, they're not me. But when companies have to make decisions, they're not asking rabbis either. But if we were to ask the halachic question, should a government permit things that will increase food production if as a result it introduces a certain risk of disease? It is a difficult halachic question. It is a trolley problem, and it's not so simple what the answer is going to be. That's all. I'm not referring to you as an individual person. I'm referring to how you make those decisions.
It's a risk of life for everyone. Like, everyone wants food.
Everyone what?
If you have, everybody, it's not like you're going to get to eat and then someone else will starve. It's like we're all going to starve.
You're 100% correct. You've identified an important difference between the trolley situation and the pesticide situation. In the trolley situation, we know that if I don't turn the trolley, the 5 kids will die. And if I turn the trolley, only that one person will die. So I know it's them against them, or him against them. When you're dealing with the pesticides, you're dealing with unknown people. We don't know who will die from the pesticides. We don't know who will die from the cancer. It might be that the same people would die and less of them. Meaning to say, it might be that the people who would have died of starvation might be the same people who will die of the cancer. And you're not endangering new people. They were in the old danger as well. So perhaps if you're lowering the numbers, that would be justified. Right. I'll give you an example that kind of illustrates your point. Again, I'm going far afield, but okay, we do that a lot. Sometimes we just move from topic to topic. Let's consider it like this. Let's consider the World Trade Center. Do you remember the World Trade Center, 2001? Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's imagine we have a plane. This is what happened, right? We have a plane of terrorists together with innocent people that is heading towards the World Trade Center. Okay? If they impact, they kill, let's say, 3,000 people. But let's assume I could shoot down the plane before it gets there. Now, if the only people on the plane were the terrorists, that's very simple. There's no that's not even a Shiloh. There's no question. You can certainly kill terrorists. That's a whole other principle. that says you can always kill the person that is threatening your life or the life of other people. That's nothing to do with this problem. But here is the problem. If I shoot down the plane, I'm going to kill 250 innocent people. Now, if you're going to argue, well, wait a second. Yes, I'm going to kill 250 innocent people, but by killing 250 innocent people, I'm going to save 3,000.
They're going to die anyway, aren't they?
That's the equivalent, right? So the question would be, okay, can I kill 250 to save 3,000? Now, you might think, I just told you for the trolley case, okay, that's very critical. In the trolley case, I told you that according to the Rambam, I'm not allowed to kill one person in order to save five, and the same thing would be 100 or 1,000. So if I'm not allowed to kill one to save a large number, then would I be allowed to kill 250 to save 3,000? The answer is it would be permitted, and the reason is because the 250 are going to die anyway. Meaning,
How is that different in the city?
Okay, yeah, that's a good question. Then the Ketzer Mishnah asked the question. But the Ketzer Mishnah says, in the case of the city, it's possible that the person could hide or the person could escape. Meaning, it's not as, things are possible. Even if a plane crashes, there might be a survivor, but that's so unlikely. So this is very important. There's a big difference between killing this person to save that person and killing this person who would die with that person in order to save that person. Now, in some ways, the pesticides might be similar to the World Trade Center, because some of the people who will die of cancer might be the people who would have died of starvation. So, in a sense, I'm lowering the number of people who will die without having new people who will die. You know, but the problem is you don't know that. That's totally unknown, right? But you are correct. Yeah, there is that difference. Yeah.
Is it a different question if you're already using pesticides, whether you can stop using them?
Because you're introducing, you're making it more dangerous?
Because now if you're taking away the pesticides, yeah, you might be decreasing the amount of cancer.
Yes.
But you might be increasing the starvation.
Well, that's right. I think it's largely going to be the same question, meaning because either way, you're making a decision that will save lives, but maybe at the expense of other lives. Now, I don't want to get into the pesticides example exclusively, because obviously I'm positing a dichotomy. You either have pesticides or you have starvation. I mean, Baruch Hashem, there are technologies out there where you might be able to increase the food yield without increasing cancer, right? So when you can do it that way, that's the best way to do it. But all I'm saying is, if you have to make a choice, the choice is not going to be that simple. By the way, that was the basis, too, of the big, I don't know how many of you are into health food, I am not in particular, but this is the whole controversy about genetically modified food. I mean, genetic modification of food has been responsible for great, great increases in crop yielding. They were able to create, you know, things that are resistant to disease and the like, but there are many people that feel it introduces all sorts of unhealthy influences in the food supply. That's why in the European Union they have very strict rules about no genetically modified food and the like.
There's a question of, yeah, are you allowed to eat technically unhealthy food?
Well, that's a good question. Again, I want to point out, again, I'll admit that I myself am not as conscientious as I should be, so do as I say, not as I do, but the truth of the matter is, this idea that one is not allowed to endanger their health, this does not only apply to dangerous activities, it also applies to the diet that one should have, the obligation of exercise. There are obligations to take care of our health. And in fact, the Alter Rebbe, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, states this in a very, very beautiful way. He says that the obligation not to endanger ourselves is based on the fact that our bodies do not belong to us. Our physical bodies is the property of Hashem. And the same way, if I gave you my car to watch, you would have to protect and preserve the automobile from damage. So too, our bodies are not our own. Our bodies belong to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that is the basis of all of these obligations. There's even a shaila about cosmetic surgery. Let's say I want to have I don't mean if a person's a burn victim, that's not a question. But let's say a person, usually it's women, but you know, men might have it as well. A person wants a nose job or some type of other cosmetic surgery just because they want to look better for shiduchim or whatever it might be. So it's not so simple. Number one, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you?
Shidduchim is allowed, always.
Okay. You lie about your age, right? I know. Yeah, I know.
You can lie about your age.
No. Some people, if you're asking me, I say no, but there are some people who say, yeah.
Absolutely. They're going to find out anyway at some point.
They find out after the wedding. That's
where they're divorced.
Well, the hope is they will see all of your positive, wonderful characteristics. They will overlook that one. No. I'm not. By the way, I am not. Okay. I mean, I will tell you that one should never lie. One should never lie at a shidduch, but one can be gradual in introducing the truth. Let me give you a concrete example. Let's say this is very relevant with medical conditions and the like. Let's say somebody had a medical condition, or let's say somebody is taking medication for. Whether it's OCD or whether it's depression, whatever it might be. Now, the halacha is 1,000% clear that those conditions must be disclosed to the other person before the marriage. Must. Otherwise, it is deceptive and it is forbidden. Not only is it forbidden to lie, but there's an obligation to disclose it. But here is the thing. You don't have to disclose it before you meet the person. Because if people hear there's a problem, if somebody makes a shidduch for me or for a woman and says, oh, this person is taking pills for depression, then I don't even want to meet the person. What do I want a problem for? But it might be that the person should be given a chance to also show the other side of themselves, to show that they're a nice person, that they seem to be functioning well. And then when you've seen the positive, then I can talk about the negative. Meaning, one needs to talk to a rabbi about this. But all I'm saying is that in shidduchim, ultimately, before things progress to a serious level, there must be honesty and disclosure, 100%. And unfortunately, sometimes that doesn't happen, and that's very, very unfortunate. And there are divorces that happen because of this. But there is a concept that you do have a right to initially put your best foot forward before you talk about it. So people give different levels. Either you don't bring it up till after a second date or a third date or sometimes in a fourth date, but no later than that. It is brought up before things get serious. So if you have any shilas, again, talk to Rabbi Levinger or other rabbis or rebbetzins.
About the actual medication. Like, what does halacha say about like ADHD medication and all those things? Like, because it's a weird concept because like,
Halacha considers psychiatric medications as permissible ways of making yourself more functional. Now, one has to be careful not to abuse them, and one has to be careful of side effects, and one needs to, know that you're taking the right dose. But in principle, halacha is not averse, and it's even encouraging, of doing whatever therapies are effective in making you more efficient and more able to cope with life. So we do not have an anti-medication view of life. We believe that technology is part of Hashem's processes to enable us to become better functioning. Now again, I'm not saying we endorse indiscriminately taking medicine for every condition, and I'm also not discussing alternative medicine, which may have a role. All I'm saying is, if it works, halacha permits you to use it. You don't have to say it has to be natural and the like. Okay? So that medication is permitted. And again, for shidduchim, we have all of this this idea that you do have the right to have somebody know you before, or know your good attributes before the negative. So again, please be sure you understand what I'm saying. The negatives do have to be disclosed. They do have to be revealed. There cannot be lying. There cannot be any holding things back, but you can delay when you bring it out so a person understands. Now, there's other questions about that. Is there such a thing as a statute of limitations? Let me give you an example of this. Let's say a man was married many, many years ago, or a man, whatever it is, he's like 40, and when he was 20, he slapped his wife or slapped his girlfriend, and now he's engaged. And there has been no reoccurrence of any type of behavior like that since then. Do you take the position, what does halacha say if I'm a rabbi and I happen to know that he did this 20 years ago? Do I tell the girl?
No,
it's not me.
Well, 20 years later.
Okay, so again,
you slap is a different situation.
You understand,
like,
right?
If it's like maybe assault or something,
right,
like that,
right.
There's a file.
So there are people, in the abuse community, including the religious Jews, who do take a very strong position that once an abuser, you know, always an abuser. On the other hand, we do believe in tshuva, we believe in repentance, we believe in the capacity of human beings to change. Now, so your position is, if it's only one slap, what's the expression? You get one free slap, huh? Okay. That's your... Now, of course, the question would be, what would you say if instead of slapping his girlfriend, what if he sexually abused a child? What if he had one incidence of pedophilia, but he never repeated it?
Oh my God, yes.
You know, again, I'm not here to answer questions right now, but...
But you should. You can't leave us like this.
No. So I would think... So again, what this illustrates is a very important point. What this illustrates is that the rabbi that is hopefully an expert in halacha needs to be very well connected to the medical and mental health communities. Meaning, the issue that I as a rabbi would face is, what a person did in his past is not relevant. The reason why I would tell the girl is not because he has a bad past. The past is past. The problem is his past behavior a predictor of what he might do in the future? The only thing we care about is what type of husband he will be. What type of father will he be? What type of mother she will be? What type of wife she will be? The past is not intrinsically important. See, your past is not important. Your past is only important if it will shape the type of way you'll behave in the marriage. So the very agonizingly difficult problem that a rabbi has is, okay, this is a guy or a woman for that matter, who did bad things in the past. But if those bad things are finished and they're not going to repeat, then I should keep my mouth shut. If, on the other hand, there is a fear that it may repeat, then I have to tell the other party. So the big issue is the rabbi needs... Well, there's no final determination, but basically... the rabbi that is posketing this question would need to discuss it with psychiatrists, psychologists, maybe with the person himself. In other words, the issue. But you understand the issue. The issue, and this is very important about everybody here. People might have pasts. Your pasts are not necessarily things that you have to talk about or disclose. But if they are relevant regarding the future, so for example, if somebody has a sexual history, that doesn't have to be discussed. But if somebody has genital herpes because of that sexual history, that has to be discussed, right? Etc. That has to come up in one way. Again, it's a very delicate, but in one way. Yeah. Do you see the difference here? It's not the past that's important, does the past affect the future? And that's going to sometimes be an unknown. The rabbi is not going to know that on his own. The rabbi needs to consult with mental health professionals. Otherwise, you have a phenomenon that's called garbage in, garbage out, meaning a psak halacha, even if somebody knows the whole Talmud, a psak halacha is only as good as the information that the Rav has. If the Rav does not have accurate information, the halachic decision is not going to be correct. That's why a rabbi can, and in fact, this will, in fact, I'll even call this a mission statement here, because this will happen over and over again in end of life decision making, really all sorts of decisions, shidduchim, this whole issue that a rabbi today, and I'm even talking about the greatest rabbis, does not function in isolation. There needs to be networks The rabbis needs to have engineers to understand technology for Shabbos. You know, are you allowed to have alarm systems on Shabbos? A rabbi needs doctors to understand the science of organ donation or end-of-life treatment. A rabbi needs mental health professionals, psychologists, psychiatrists, and social workers to understand you know, whether an abuser is likely to repeat if there was only one time, and the like. And without that input, the psak halacha itself is not going to be accurate. Another example, abortion, right? Abortion, again, it's a topic for another time, but abortion is permitted when the mother's life is in danger, right? We know that, right? But the rabbi himself doesn't determine if the mother's life is in danger. That's not kind of a medical, that's a medical issue, a psychiatric issue. The rabbi cannot just say, oh, your life is in danger, or your life is not in danger. There has to be a consultation with people outside of the system. Optimally, it would be best if those people would also be religious Jews, so they would share a value system. But even if they're not Jews or they're not religious Jews, if they have the knowledge, we need to tap into it. That is why, you know, to be a truly good halachic posek, you have to be involved with a lot of people outside of the halachic system to be able to understand that. Okay, so this was a long digression, but now to move. But now to move back to organ donation, this is the primary issue we have with kidneys. When a person donates a kidney, or a person donates a liver, part of their liver, they are to some degree putting themselves in a certain amount of danger, because there is a potential for overstressing the one kidney that remains, and perhaps part of the liver as well, until it regenerates.
Good question.
I didn't hear you say again?
Good question. Is bungee jumping against halacha?
Is what?
Bungee jumping.
Okay. Are you a bungee jumper?
Potentially.
Okay. Yeah. So I tell you, I always use bungee jumping. I want to tell you, I always
use a motorcycle.
Excellent point. Okay, let me address both of them. I've always used bungee jumping as an example of real dangerous things you're not supposed to do. But somebody showed me, one of my students in Or Sameach, that's my men's job, showed me some numbers about how wonderfully safe bungee jumping is. I couldn't believe it. He says, it's a lot safer than driving a car.
Yeah,
you know? So he says, it's real safe. Now, I wanted to know this, though. I wanted to know, there needs to be a separation between beginning jumpers and experienced. In other words, you're mixing all the jumpers together and you're saying it's real safe. Yeah, I know. But I wonder if the, you know, what's the rate for the first time bungee jumpers? I think it might be a little more dangerous.
No, it depends where you go.
It's the same.
Okay. So what I would tell you is this. If the activity is no more dangerous than the activities that society accepts as reasonable, such as driving, then it seems that it's permitted.
But like climbing Mount Everest is like not successful.
That's correct. We wouldn't accept that. Now, motorcycle is really the same thing. Motorcycle is considered to be acceptable driving. It is more dangerous than a car, but it is considered to be a reasonably safe method of transportation, provided, of course, you wear a helmet and drive carefully. So I can't tell you it's forbidden, although I wouldn't want my son to do a motorcycle.
But doctors call motorcycles donut-cycles.
Say again?
Doctors call motorcycles donut-cycles.
Yes. That's very, very true. In fact, we'll get to this when we talk about organ donors, but they say that the ideal organ donor, that's exactly right, is a healthy teenage kid that was riding a motorcycle without a helmet. Because there you got a smashed brain and a healthy body. And Baruch Hashem, he has a wonderful heart that we can take and give to somebody else. In fact, there was even a story, I think it was a bad joke, I don't believe it was an honest story, that when Pennsylvania was trying to pass a law requiring a motorcycle helmet, the organ donor lobby opposed the law because they said there are going to be fewer donors for vital organs. That sounds to me like a bad joke. I don't think it's true, but this is the story that was reported. So all right. So basically, what we've been digressing as an introduction to this, and we've been discussing the general idea of don't engage in unreasonable self-endangerment. By the way, just for a moment, where in the Torah do you see that, by the way? In other words, where does the Torah say, thou shalt not put yourself in danger? So it's interesting, there is actually a mitzvah that represents that. One is the negative commandment of ma'akeh, mem, ayin, kuf, hey. Ma'akeh is the obligation in the Torah that if you have a flat roof that people walk on, you are halachically obligated to build a fence on that roof so that people should not fall off the roof, etc. In fact, I heard before the class as well, you were discussing uncovered liquid. So let me just tell you this. Although there are Kabbalistic reasons for it, but the original reason of the Gemara, the original reason, was a health-based consideration, and it was based on the idea that in places that have a lot of snakes, this is what the Gemara says, snakes would come and they would drink from the liquid and they would expel snake venom into the liquid, and if you drank the uncovered water or liquid, you could die from the snake venom. So this was a health precaution not to do dangerous things. The question then becomes, so today we don't have snakes that slither around, is it still forbidden? So then there are Kabbalistic secondary additional reasons as well. But in its inception, it was absolutely a health-based consideration based on snake venom and the like. That's why it even says certain drinks snakes didn't like beer snakes didn't like. So beer could be uncovered because no snake is gonna drink the beer. Yeah.
Does this at all have to do with afflicting your body, like you can't get tattoos and things?
Yes.
Like that?
Yeah. Well. Generically, I would subsume it all under this. Meaning, the specific thing we're talking about is don't do things that endanger your health. But you are correct. Based on the Alter Rebbe's, no, I understand, but the Alter Rebbe's concept that your body is not your own, this is also the key to another set of halachas, which are not about endangering health, but about bodily mutilation, body piercing, tattoos.
Body piercing.
Yeah, I'll get to body piercing in a moment, but body piercing, now again, I'm not talking about piercing the... Let me start with tattoos first. I'll get body piercing is a little more complicated. Tattoos. It is forbidden to get a tattoo. There is no question that is a negative commandment in the Torah. Now, here is something that everybody in the world has heard, and it's incorrect. Every no matter how unreligious a person is, they have heard this. I am sure you've heard that if you have a tattoo, you're not allowed to be buried in a Jewish cemetery. Every Jew in the world knows this, and it's totally not true.
I think it's just something your mother tells you.
Yeah, but I've never heard of a teaching of Judaism that like everybody knows, and it's totally incorrect.
And then they just burn it off, right?
Well, let me start. Okay, so you can be buried in a Jewish cemetery. That's perfectly fine.
With a tattoo.
With a tattoo, yeah. They don't take off the tattoo.
No, but,
yeah. No, they do not. No.
I thought. No.
You're buried with your tattoo. Now, the only thing is, it is absolutely clear you're not allowed to get a tattoo. Now, let's say a person has a tattoo and now they become religious. Do they have to remove it? They actually don't. They do not have to remove it. Now, I think if it can be removed, we would encourage it because it's part of your new identity to be religious. But halachically, the issue is to get one. If you have one, then Nebuch. In fact, they have a story, a very famous story they tell. Again, it's a kind of a beautiful story in a way. You know, men go to the mikveh. Well, some Hasidim go to the mikveh every day, but even non-Hasidim, they make a point of going to the mikveh erev Rosh Hashanah, the day before, and erev Yom Kippur. Everybody goes to the mikveh those days. So there was a boy who was a Baal Tshuva, a person who was New Judaism, but he had a tattoo on his arm. And he was going to the mikveh in Jerusalem where there's so many righteous tzaddikim, and he was so ashamed of his tattoo, so he was, so his plan was, it was on his arm. He was like covering his arm and walking, and then the last minute he goes to the mikveh under the water, up, you know, and nobody would see. And what happened was, you know, he's walking along, and there's a lot of people in the mikveh then, and he's walking along, and he slips on the floor, and he exposes his arm. And everybody sees the tattoo, and it's like those movies when everything is silent and slow motion. And everybody's looking. Well, maybe at least he thinks. I'm not sure if it was that case. But he has this vision that everybody is looking at him. And everybody is staring at him. So an old man went over to him and said, he showed him, he was in a concentration camp. And he had a tattoo on his arm from the Nazis. And he said, you know, I have one too. Let's go to the mikveh together and we can welcome the new year as servants of Hashem. And, you know, so that was an idea. Now, someone asked me a very fascinating shaila. Imagine this, based on what I told you, imagine this. There was a non-Jewish person who was about to convert to Judaism. He was about to convert to Judaism. He was very religious, etc. But he really had a longing for a beautiful tattoo. So here is his question. I know, once I convert, I can't do it. But if I have it before my conversion, I can keep it. So he wanted to know, the day before I go to the mikveh, can I get my tattoo? It's like we tell a person, have your last cheeseburger. Now that's a little different. The cheeseburger is in and out of your system. This, unfortunately, is something that stays. You know, I think it's very different. I felt a person should not do that because God does not want Jews to have tattoos.
That means he's not sincere enough to accept every single halacha.
Well, he said he did accept the law against, in other words, he accepted he would not get another tattoo. Right? See, a non-Jew can have a tattoo, right? So he's not doing any sin by his activity. Okay, now that's tattoo. Now, body. What about body piercing that's not a tattoo? Body piercing. Is that again? That's 100% correct. You're correct. In the Chumash, it mentions nose rings and earrings and the like. So, generally speaking, in soft cartilage that closes up when you take out the thing, we do permit. That's why even Hasidic little girls have their ears pierced, right? Little Jewish princesses have their ears pierced and the like. But if you're talking about heavy body piercing, we do discourage that. That's why I mentioned cosmetic surgery. We actually discourage unless a person is so embarrassed. If a person is embarrassed by their appearance, although they shouldn't be, but if a person is embarrassed, so we permit it for embarrassment. But if a person simply wants surgical enhancement, the halacha is that that would be discouraged. I'm not saying it's usher, but it would be discouraged because you're taking God's body and you're trying to improve it in various ways. So you are correct, although that is not a endangerment issue, but it is connected with the notion. You're right. So hair removal for a woman is considered to be something that's embarrassing. So we permit these procedures for embarrassment purposes. The same thing. Right? So we do allow that. Yeah.
This is a very complicated subject. Yep. What about people who are transgender and they want to have surgery?
Oh, okay. So we're going very far afield today, but I'll address it at least briefly.
These are questions that women ask themselves every day.
Well, I hope it's not that question. Okay.
Yeah. I said, what about people who are transgender?
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Don't ask that.
You know, this was a problem in YU. Yeshiva University is supposed to be a religious college, right? That one of the English professors was a man, and the man underwent surgery and became a woman. And the question was whether Yeshiva University should maintain that person, since that's something that's not really a Jewish thing to do. You know, they did, but okay. But a lot of the rabbis there were opposed. But let me explain two issues. I want to address briefly two different questions. One is an actual sex change, man to woman, woman to man. And the other is gender assignment when there's androgyny. Those are two different issues. Androgyny, which is not so infrequent, it's like one in 5,000. It's not like amazing. Androgyny is when, unfortunately, a child is born with both sets of genitalia, in whole or in part. Okay, two different questions. Let's first take like the Bruce Jenner thing. Let's take the idea where a man wants to be a woman wants to be a man. Okay, let's take that. So I have to say there are two issues. Are you allowed to have such a surgery? And number two, if you have such a surgery, what is the effect of it? Are you allowed to have such a surgery? Halacha basically says it is forbidden. It is forbidden to anatomically change your gender. Now, I don't mean to be insensitive. I understand there might be all sorts of psychological conflicts, and hopefully Hashem will give ways in which those conflicts can be addressed. I'm not dismissing the pain that anybody faces, but anatomically switching your gender is halachically forbidden, because one of the things the Torah prohibits is castration. So the removal of male sexual organs is forbidden castration, and the removal of female reproductive organs is forbidden. In fact, you're not even allowed to do it for dogs, which is the whole problem. How do you spay a dog or a cat? But let's just talk about humans right now and the like. So to do the operation is forbidden because it is a violation of castration. Now, okay, but let's say I had the operation done. A person had the operation done. Is the man a woman, or is the woman a man? In other words, what is the effect of the operation? So that's a very big machlokas. There are many, many poskim that say sexual identity is established at birth and it cannot be changed. Which means, even if a man, this is amazing, even if a man has now turned into a woman, halachically, they are still a man. Halachically, they are still a man, even if the man was castrated. They would count as a minion. Other rabbis take the position that...
If they look like a woman, would they have to sit in the woman's section?
You know, this is very, very crazy. You'd have to make a third section for transgender, because the person cannot sit with the men because he looks like a woman. But he can't sit with the women because he is halachically a man. So we would have to have the transgender. Yes. Now, on the other hand, there was a great rabbi, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, who did take the position that although halacha does not permit sex change operations, halacha recognizes their effect. So according to Rabbi Waldenberg, the man who surgically became a woman, even though that's forbidden, that is forbidden, is now halachically a woman. Let me give you an example halachically how this works. Let's take a get, right? We know, I mean, let's say... Rav Waldenberg says, again, be sure you understand this, everybody says the sex change operation is forbidden to do. Yeah. That's not the issue. Yeah. The only, right, that's for sure. Yeah. The only question is, okay, I'm not allowed to do it, but does halacha recognize the effectiveness of the gender change? Mm-hmm. So many rabbis say, no, you are what you were born as. If you were born a man, you're a man. If you're born a woman, you're a woman. No matter what you do to yourself, your identity, your neshama, is fixed and established. The exception to this is the view of Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg. And Rabbi Waldenberg says that although these sex change operations are forbidden, they are forbidden, but they are effective in reestablishing a new identity. So according to him, the man who becomes a woman is now halachically a woman. They can halachically get married to a man. Mm-hmm. It's not homosexual sex and the like. Now, this is very fascinating. Let's imagine a man that was married to a woman. Halachically, halachic marriage. And now the man has a sex change operation, has become a woman. Does he have to give his wife a get? According to Rav Waldenberg, he doesn't have to give his wife a get, because the man has now become a woman. As a woman, he's not married to a woman, and therefore she doesn't need a get. According to the other rabbi, she would have to give him a get. She would have to give her a get. And if she, if his wife turned into a man, it would be a case of the woman giving the man the get. Okay. Okay, so that's a big machlokas. Now.
Isn't there a context of a male soul being into a female body and vice versa?
Well, yes, but halacha would regard that as a psychiatric condition and not a spiritual condition, meaning to say it would be a sickness. It would be a particular sickness. And it would have to be treated as a psychiatric condition. It would not be treated as a gender identity. Now, let me point out that I've been talking about a definite man going to a woman and or a definite woman going into a man. Now, let's move to a different aspect, and that is the androgynous child. Now, that's a very, very totally different than a Bruce Jenner situation.
5,000?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I have to check.
I don't think parents tell their kids.
No, they don't.
Well, okay.
Usually at birth, it's just decided.
Yeah. So the thing is this. So the thing is that the clinic in the United States, that's the that is their specialty, Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore. That's why I know a little bit about it. Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore. Does have a gender assignment or a sex assignment clinic, and they're kind of the world's specialists in gender reassignment. It's very, very difficult. I mean, they do sex change operations as well, which halacha doesn't allow. But when you're dealing with androgyny would be, there would be both a male organ or maybe a micropenis, there'd be something, and female. Sometimes, in rare cases, they're both fully developed. That's a true androgynous. And most of the time, there's a primary identity with a little bit of something of the other.
What about the rest of the body?
A newborn baby is a little harder to analyze, but there may be a uterus. It depends. There are many different combinations of this, meaning you can have any stage of combination. So here, halacha does permit. This is very different. Although halacha does not allow you to turn a man into a woman, and halacha does not allow you to turn a woman into a man, but halacha does say if there's no definitive gender status, the parents can decide. Now that's a very complicated problem. Doctors prefer, in cases of androgyny, they prefer to change to female because that's a little bit of an easier thing, because it's easier to take away than to reconstruct. Meaning to say, if there is female organs but just a male thing, a male organ, that could be removed.
What if that woman starts growing a beard and like?
Well. Obviously, this is augmented. I mean, this is augmented with hormones. It's augmented with all sorts of things. And this is done very young. This is done very. We're not talking about taking an 8-year-old in. So, although sometimes that's done, we're talking about 6 months. So we're talking about very, very, very early. Now, there are some crazy parents, which are really crazy. They want to live in what's called a post-gender world. And they say why does a child have to have a gender? Why do they have to be male or female? They're a human being, and they're actually trying to raise their child without a gender.
I don't know if it's so much like they're raising them without a gender.
Yeah.
They're for sure parents like that, but I think it's like without like the social norms that are attached to being a boy.
Okay. That's another aspect. In fact, there are parents who are actually raising definite boys or girls. In a gender-free environment, that's another issue. Yeah.
Is she though? Not gender-free, but like as like they don't need to be like girls don't need to play with baby dolls.
No. I didn't mean to say. Listen, I don't mean to say that if a girl wants to play with a toy machine gun, you know, we have to, you know, fight that. But certainly in Judaism, men and women have different roles and different functions, so to try to obliterate or ignore those distinctions, I think would be incorrect. Now again, some things might be minor. A girl doesn't have to enjoy playing with dolls. I agree. You know, you don't have to impose.
That was just a side point. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I didn't even
totally start. No. That's fine.
Also, say anything about like these kids who are like born like in between, like in limbo, like. Why can't the parents, is there any case where they could just let them grow up a little and see what is
No, you're 100% correct. In other words, I'm not saying, you're right. I'm not saying gender assignment has to be a decision that's made right away. You can wait and see the personnel.
What about, like, breasts and stuff?
With what? Well, I think there would be an issue. Theoretically, if there is the possibility of doing a Brit, you would do a Brit simply because you don't know what the status is yet. But you can wait and see on some of these things. But I wouldn't wait too long because it gets more psychologically traumatic. When the kid is 15, you don't want to, you know, you don't want a 15-year-old not to know if he's a not to know if he's a boy or a girl. That can be very confusing.
I think that, like, there's, like, a certain time in a child's life where they just start to identify. Like,
okay.
Yeah.
I think that's legitimate. The point that I want to bring out here is that halacha has a sharp distinction between when a person has a definitive identity and wants to change it versus ambiguous identity, where halacha does permit an assignment of that identity. You don't have to remain in limbo, rather you could actually make some decision can be made. Okay? So, how did I get onto this? I have no idea, but you had brought up the idea that... Yeah. Okay, but these are issues. Again, I mean... Yes, just Hashem, no one.
Huh?
Androgyny.
Way before that.
I didn't hear you.
Androgyny.
No, that's androgyny just means. Androgyny is treated as a doubtful situation, meaning to say, we don't know if he's a male or he or she is a male or a female. That is why there is a special obligation to try to give him or her. A definitive identity, primarily because androgyny. In fact, it's interesting. The word in the Talmud is actually this word. The word in the Talmud for what's called a hermaphrodite is androgynous. Androgynous is the same word as androgyny. Androgynous is actually the Talmudic term. It's from the Greek, and that's the term that we use. Okay. Yeah.
Can we please just go through, because I've already written down there are three different types of organ donations and I only have one now.
Yes. Oh, okay. we're going to continue this, but the three. Okay, the three are live organ donations.
Yes, alive. Yep.
That's the one we're still in the middle of. The next one is cadaveric organ donations.
Sorry.
Cadaveric meaning from dead bodies. C A D A V E R I C cadaveric from a cadaver.
Yeah, and that's
when
dead bodies.
And we didn't even finish the first one yet, but that's...
it's like a definition, so we're alive.
Cadaveric means organs removed from a dead body.
Okay. Yeah.
And the third is brain death organ donations, when the brain is destroyed, but the heart is still beating, and that's going to be a question, dead or alive, that's going to be the big question. So, for example, heart transplants are not from cadavers. The heart would deteriorate. Heart transplants are from brain dead donors. So the three we're going to discuss, and obviously this will take more than 1 week. We even haven't gotten to the first one tonight, but that's fine. You know, it's if other questions come up, it's perfectly fine to discuss them. Is live organ donations. The other extreme is cadaveric organ donations, and the third one is brain death organ donations, which halakhically will actually be the most complicated and controversial of the three, and that would involve heart transplants. Heart transplants are not cadaveric; they are based on brain death, because if you waited until somebody was a cadaver, the heart muscle would deteriorate and would not be suitable for transplantation. Okay, alrighty. So now I think we'll move back now to organ donation, and we're talking about live organ donation. And again, with all of the highways and the byways, you understand that we walk away with a bottom line that you're not supposed to recklessly endanger yourself. So the question is, am I allowed to give a kidney given the fact that I am endangering myself? So here the poskim say an interesting concept. They say the following: even though you're not supposed to endanger yourself, but if you're doing so to potentially save the life of a person who will very definitely die unless you do so, you're not obligated, but it's treated as a mitzvah if you're willing to do it. So, if a person gives a kidney, they are increasing the danger to themselves, but it's not necessarily a tremendous danger. Many people can live with one kidney, and although you have to watch your diet, etc., but you know, you can live a normal you can have a normal life expectancy. So the way halacha describes it is a mitzvah to donate a kidney, but it is not an obligation to do so. You are not obligated to put yourself at risk, even to save another person's life. But if you're able to do so, it is a meritorious good deed for which God will give you reward. Now, because of that, because it's not an obligation, it's a good deed, it's what we call a mitzvah, that if you do it, it's a mitzvah, but it's not an obligation. So whether or not you should do it depends on your situation. For example, if you're a young mother, or if you're a mother with young children, and you want to give a kidney, I think we would advise you not to do it. Because you're trying to be a nice person to help that other person, but what if that's going to compromise your ability to take care of your family? If, on the other hand, your children are grown up, or even if you're single, perhaps, there might be different cheshbonot, but you understand that this is a very fact-intensive. Now, let me give you a case that actually happened in Israel. And this is a fascinating case, and then I want to compare it with the case that happened in America. The case that happened in Israel was the following. Again, I'm going to make up ages. I don't remember the exact ages, but the general facts are these facts. Let's imagine you had an 18-year-old boy who needed a kidney, right? He had renal failure, and he would die. And even dialysis, he'd only be in dialysis for up to a certain amount of time. His life was in danger. And as you know, in all organ donations, the key issue that you need is you need genetic compatibility, you know, because the body rejects organs. In fact, that's the same method by which we fight disease, by our immune system. The body attacks. That's why people with organ donations have to take anti-rejection drugs that compromise their immunity tremendously. And if they get a cold, you know, they could die from a cold because there's nothing in their body that fights. So there was no compatible donor. The only compatible renal donor was his 11-year-old brother. His 11-year-old brother was a compatible donor. The brother wanted to give a kidney to his older brother, and the parents wanted him to give a kidney to his older brother. But you know what the Psak Halacha was? That since there is no obligation to give an organ, it is only a voluntary decision. A child who is below the age of bar mitzvah is not capable of making that decision because he doesn't have the maturity, and the parents cannot make that decision, because although parents can make medical decisions for their children, they can only make medical decisions for the benefit of the child. They cannot make a medical decision to endanger one child in order to save another child. If the kid would be bar mitzvah, he could make his own decision. But if he's not bar mitzvah, he cannot make the decision, and the parents cannot make the decision. Now, if you think that sounds harsh, let me just tell you that in the United States, secular law, I don't know about Israel secular law, but the United States secular law is largely the same. Minors cannot consent to donate vital organs. They can give blood, but they cannot consent to give a vital organ. And remember, too, that in the United States, you are a minor until the age of 18.
In halacha,
you are an adult at the age of 13 for a boy and 12 for a girl. So according to halacha, a 12-year-old girl can donate a kidney. In secular law, a 12-year-old girl will not be allowed. Yeah, did you want? What did you say?
Yeah, you know, my sister's keeper, that book by Gertie Kapol.
I heard of it. Yeah.
It's the whole thing where they have another child who they know will be a match for.
Okay, that's the next thing I'm gonna. I'm gonna bring that up. Okay, let me bring it up. I didn't bring it up from her. I bring it up from another case. Okay, so very good. Mama's gonna bring that up. Now, here is the thing. This story had a tragic ending. The tragic ending, I understand, was that the older brother died of kidney failure because there was no compatible donor. Now, if I... Well, there was, but there was no other compatible donor. Now, If I would have been the rabbi there, I think there would have been another way to get around it. I would have said the following. I would have said that to take the organ from the child is not only for the benefit of his older brother, it's for the benefit of the child himself. That's correct. And there are two reasons why that's so. Number one, it would give him the camaraderie of a brother. And number two, although the child shouldn't feel guilty because he was willing, but I think, exactly as you said, there's a great trauma in, he'll go through life thinking, mm-hmm. I could have saved my brother's life. Mm-hmm. And my brother died because I didn't. So one could have said, this is not a case of donating just to somebody out there. I think the nature of the family relationship. Okay, but
be it. Is there a country in the world that that would have been allowed?
You know, I don't know. I don't know. And I'm not sure. But I know in the United States, they generally, I believe the law is, they do not take organs from minors.
But
now, what would have been? Well, in Israel,
they
also
followed the Torah. No.
The state of Israel does not follow the Torah most of the time. Remember, the state of Israel is a.
So, what's the age in Israel?
I believe it would also be 18, not 13. Okay, now let me give you another case. Now maybe this is what Jody Picoult was talking about. This was an actual case, and they made a movie out of it too, but it was an actual case. These involved non-Jews, but we're going to then make believe they were Jewish.
My sister's keeper?
Right, my sister's keeper, that's right. This involved a teenage girl that had leukemia, and she needed a bone marrow transplant. Okay, now, bone marrow, they have registries. They have all sorts of registries of compatible.
Are we allowed to donate?
Yes, you are. You are certainly allowed to donate, absolutely. But the question was that there was no compatible donor on the registry for her leukemia, and her parents were not good. So her parents had this brilliant idea, let's conceive a child so that we might have a compatible donor. Now this was quite an amazing story because Dad had had a vasectomy a short while before and he would have to get the vasectomy surgically reversed, and which is only a 40% chance that he could gain fertility. Mom was undergoing chemotherapy for breast cancer, so she couldn't get pregnant until she went into remission and the drugs came out of her system. Mom was also over 40, in which fertility anyway is sharply, you know, she wasn't in menopause, but it sharply goes down. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu had rachamim on the family. Dad had his vasectomy surgically reversed, and it was successful. Mom went into remission. She got pregnant, and even if she got pregnant, who says the child would be a donor? And Baruch Hashem, little baby, was a compatible bone marrow donor. And I think her name was Marissa, and the older sister was Anissa. So baby Marissa became the bone marrow donor for older sister Anissa. This was like almost 20 years ago, a long time ago. And both sisters are doing well. Although somebody told me recently, maybe I didn't see the book, that Marissa is suing her parents for assault and battery because they say she was attacked as a baby. Okay, now, so everything turns into a lawsuit. Now, at the time, in the newspapers and in the magazines, people were discussing the ethical, and that's what Jody Picoult was talking about, the ethical issues of conceiving a child to be a donor for another child. Now, I would just say that, in a way, halakha does not consider that a problem, because, I mean, listen, we live in a society where if there would be abortion, that's perfectly okay. And not halakha. So it's a very strange thing that when a child is born and loved, conceived and loved and taken care of, oy, ethical problem. If they were just abort, no problem. You know, that's the 614th mitzvah, is thou shalt have abortion on demand. So it's strange. It's a little bizarre sometimes. But here's the question I want to raise. I just want to raise this question. Now, I just told you, we're not allowed to take a kidney from a 12-year-old boy to save his brother. That's what I just told you. Now, I'm telling you, we took bone marrow from a 6-month-old baby to save her sister. Are these reconcilable? Or indeed, had the Ayala family asked the rabbi would have said no. or do you see a distinction between removal of a kidney and bone marrow?
Mm-hmm. Huh? It's not as dangerous.
Yeah, so that's the key. The key point is that there's a mitzvah to save other people's lives. The only thing is you don't have to do it if you're exposing yourself to danger. So the concept was that giving up a vital organ that does not regenerate, does not grow back, is putting yourself in danger. Because even though you have one kidney, but there's an excessive stress. So that was the psak. Only an adult could give permission for that. Ma she'ein kein, this is not the case, in the case of bone marrow. Removal of bone marrow, although it is painful and although it is done under general anesthesia for a newborn baby, anesthesia can be very delicate because if you give a little too much, you know, that's it. But it is a relatively safe procedure. It is not exposing to an unusual danger. So as a result, even if we can't take the kidney from a child, there would be a mitzvah to take the bone marrow from the child in order to save another person. That's why when you ask me, is it a mitzvah to give bone marrow, it very definitely is a mitzvah. There's of course one issue which I'm not going to fully discuss tonight, and that is it a mitzvah even if you're going to give it to a non-Jew? That raises murky, difficult issues that create some big, big problems. And that is there a mitzvah to try to save the life of a non-Jew? Let me give you an extreme example. We know that if, God forbid, somebody's life is at risk, not only are we permitted to violate the Shabbos laws, but we are commanded, right? You know this. If, God forbid, somebody has a heart attack, we take him to the hospital. We drive, we call. The guy myself had occasion. When people were sick, I didn't tell a kid to do it. I went and I picked up the phone and I dialed. I still remember I was dialing, and some little kid walked by. Hey, the rabbi's dialing the phone on Shabbos. You know, he was like, well, whatever it is. But the point is, I remember he was pointing up. Anyway, but the point is, Baruch Hashem, the person was okay. I mean, it was a serious thing. But you know, you don't even tell a kid to do it. You do it yourself because you have to make a point when it comes to saving a life. Right? You are commanded to violate. In fact, I shouldn't say violate. If you're commanded to do what is normally a violation of Shabbos. Same thing on Yom Kippur. If somebody needs to eat because their life is in danger, now again, if they're uncomfortable, that's not the same thing. But if their life is in danger, let's say they're diabetic and they're going into a diabetic coma, God forbid, they are obligated to eat whatever, you know, whatever would restore them, whatever would help them. So this is called pikuach nefesh. Saving of a life, it takes precedence over everything except for the big three. There are only three commandments in the whole Torah that you have to be willing to die before you violate. The big three. Shabbos is not one of them. Shabbos you do violate. The big three are idolatry or renunciation of Judaism. So if somebody goes over to you and says, convert to Christianity, acknowledge Jesus, or I'll kill you, you have to be willing to give up your life if necessary. The second is adultery or sexual offenses, that a person must be willing to give up their life. Now that's a little complicated because a woman might not have to. In other words, it's really referring to a man that is doing a sexual act. Meaning, if I go over to a man and I say, have intercourse, you know, rape this woman or I'll kill you, the man must give up his life. The rape victim, per se, perhaps does not have to, because that's considered to be passive. That's, again, this should never be of any practical importance to you, but at least theoretically be aware that in halacha, a female rape victim does not have to give up her life before submitting. But again,
you gotta kill someone else?
Huh?
You gotta kill someone else?
Say again?
You gotta kill someone else, though, right?
Who's allowed to kill somebody else?
Like,
yeah, the woman could kill the rapist. Yeah, yeah. No, that is correct. If that's what you mean,
if the woman can kill her rapist,
she can kill the rapist. Yeah. But what I'm saying is, if the rapist, if, let's say she doesn't have that ability, if the rapist says, "I'm going to kill you unless," then God forbid, a woman is permitted. And the third one is murder. If I go over to you and I say, "Kill them, or I'll kill you," so you can kill me, but you can't kill the innocent person. That was the trial. Those are the big three. But other than the big three, fundamentally, saving a life overrides everything, right? In Hebrew, this is called pikuach nefesh. So the big, big question is, does pikuach nefesh apply towards a non-Jew? To give you a dramatic instance, if God forbid there was a non-Jew that collapsed in front of my Yanot, let's say I know it's a non-Jew. If I didn't know, then you know, you always have to go with the benefit of the doubt. But let's say I know it's a non-Jew that collapsed in front of my Yanot, and I have a car, and it's Shabbat, it's Shabbos. Shabbat. If it's not Shabbos, then of course it's Shabbos. Am I allowed or obligated to drive, violate the Shabbos, in order to get the non-Jew to a hospital? This is very, very tricky. According to the strict law of the Shulchan Aruch, you are actually not allowed to violate the Shabbos on behalf of somebody who doesn't have the mitzvah of Shabbos. However, for all practical intents and purposes, we do violate the Shabbos. And the reason we do, you may not like this, but I...
Because we don't want enemies.
Is because we don't want to create enmity. The concept would be that if we wouldn't take care of the non-Jew, the non-Jews would hate us, and they might rise against us, and they might hurt us. So in a sense, we do desecrate the Shabbos, because it ultimately is for the protection of the Jews. Now, to be honest with you, this is a good pragmatic resolution, but it is not a fully moral resolution, because it is saying, in terms of basic morality, it is the Jew that we care about more, but practically we do it for the non-Jew, because otherwise the Jew is going to be hurt. You know, it is a difficult issue, but all I would tell you there is that it's not so much that a non-Jew is not as important. Rather, Shabbos is so important that you only desecrate Shabbos for those who have Shabbos. Meaning, it's more like you're not looking at this life is less important than that life. You're looking at how important Shabbos is. That Shabbos is so important. For example, the Gemara has an expression, violate one Shabbos so that he will keep many Shabbos. So that applies to the person who will keep, or at least may keep, many Shabbos.
Is that one way? Is that where you learn that from?
That you don't do for a non-Jew? No, that's actually not what you learn from, but that can be in support, a supportive argument. Okay, so this raises some problems. But okay, so be it as it may, our conclusion, okay, we do have a conclusion, strangely enough, our conclusion about live organ donation, which is only one out of three topics, is you are not obligated to donate a vital organ because you are endangering yourself, but if you want to do so, it is treated as a mitzvah, but because it is not an obligation, we will not accept it from a minor below bar mitzvah or bas mitzvah.
Even for a non-Jew?
So again, with the non-Jew, we would have to go with the idea that if you don't donate, it may create hatred and animosity.
Well, if you have a friend who's not Jewish and you know they need a kidney.
Yeah.
Not so everyone's running to donate.
Yes. Yes. It is a good question. I would say it is a good thing to do, but there are others who would argue with it. Others would say it's not a proper thing to do. So this is an area of disagreement. When it comes now, this is organ. When it comes to bone marrow and certainly blood, which regenerates even more quickly, then for sure there's a great mitzvah, and there an obligation, not just a mitzvah, to actually do this, because you're saving lives without endangering yourself. With the vital organ, you're endangering yourself. That's why you have the way out. Okay? So that is topic number one of live organ donations. Next time, we'll probably cover both topics, cadaveric and brain death, and go over it. Okay? Alrighty, have a real good week, and we'll see you. Yeah.
Thank you.